This is talking with Philip Morrison on 6 September 76 at the Redshift meeting in Paris. Now, could you tell me when you first sort of became aware of the fact that radio astronomy was doing something? Trained as a physicist,
that's what I think. Yeah, well, I think that the famous paper of Keeping Hoyer
Well, Kiepenheuer had one, and then Alfvén and Herlovsson had
that's
one.
That's right. Kiepenheuer and those two papers.
1950.
Kiepenheuer, 1950. That was right. When they included into the existence of astronomy. But I wasn't then really devoted to astronomy quite. And I only became really interested in it through the cosmic ray problem, I guess, in 1952 or something.
Now, can you say what the cosmic ray problem was at that time?
Well, it was a question of the origin and the time changes of cosmic rays, you see. It was the, from my point of view, the history of, I was at MIT, in the summer, and I talked to Simon Rossi, and I was thinking about the problem of cosmic rays. I guess my interest had really been whetted by the work of Bratt, Peters, and Oppenheimer, whom I knew quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we talked about these things. And that made it fairly clear, I think, for the first time, it must have been 1949, 1948. That the cosmic rays were physical phenomena and were not some cosmological, ununderstood thing as millions.
No, I'm not aware of this. I don't know much about the history of cosmic rays.
Yeah.
What do you mean by physical phenomena?
Well, I better tell you that. You see, Milne, for example, not just, I don't think it was very important to make at that time, but I would now say it's a little discovery. Milne was a cosmologist.
Yeah.
And for him, cosmic rays were probably to be interpreted as some kind of fundamental phenomenon which the whole substratum of the universe was based.
Oh, I see.
They were the marks of fundamental observers, uniform gas filling the whole universe, that sort of thing.
Oh, I see. Some property of space, essentially, one can say.
Yeah, that's right. And they were protons. They were fundamental particles. They were protons, and maybe they were electrons. That's all they were.
Was
a general point of
view. Dominant view at all?
No, I think there was no real dominant view.
The work of Compton and so forth. Established that they were particles long before World War II.
No, I didn't say they were particles. They were protons and electrons. That's particles.
Oh, I see.
But they were not produced there by physical processes. The world is made, you know. What starts the galaxies going is particles. It's protons and electrons. But how they're made is cosmology. It's very hard to study.
I see.
So that was the idea. And then sort of had a vague idea, well, maybe they are something really new, very hard to straight. Yes, they are particles. But then Peters and Oppenheimer show that they contained alpha particles and carbon nuclei, perhaps even iron. And so it was just a sample of matter. And so once you recognized that they were samples of matter, then it became extremely hopeful and plausible to say that there was some kind of matter whose physical origin was like that of other kinds of matter, but had been given high speed by some processes.
Right.
I think that was the great breakthrough.
You weren't bothered by the fact that this matter had a rather different chemical composition.
No, it's too detailed. We didn't even know the chemical composition. It had a similar chemical composition, but the point is, before this point, it was thought to be pure hydrogen. It was quite clear. And then they showed it was not pure hydrogen. It had some alpha particles, and it had some oxygen. So it was unlikely that a fundamental process that made protons, like the steady state always assumed it made protons, but the steady state would have had no support if it had to assume that the thing made oxygen. Iron 56,
nickel
50, very crazy. So you had to say these were made by some slow adiabatic process that didn't break nuclei apart. Not some instantaneous cosmic process.
That's interesting.
So from that time on, one became interested in the study of the origin of cosmic rays. It seemed like a nice problem. It was related to cosmic ray physics, and it was related to astronomy. And at the same time, the cosmic ray people were coming against the problem that the cosmic ray work looking for fundamental particles, looking for mesons and so on, was being severely competed with. Almost, they couldn't compete anymore with the machines.
Mm-hmm.
The Pi mesons were now made copiously at Berkeley.
Right.
I don't know when that was, but that would be a big landmark in 1549 or something like that. And while cosmic rays had up till then discovered the V particles and the Pi meson and the mesons, it was clearly nothing to do with it because of the competition was too keen. So cosmic ray people were looking for somewhere to go. It was this radio astronomy, and to do all these things.
In other words, take the interest away from the particles themselves and put it more as,
put it more as to where they came from and where they came through.
And
exactly. See, before that, nobody cared where they came from. There were a few theories, but they were all bizarre because nobody understood. And you just used them as a laboratory of high engineering. And two problems you worked on. What was the nature of the processes in the atmosphere that made all the complicated secondaries, and that developed a lot of fundamental physics? And second, what were the particles you saw? And that was the whole physics.
What about this very early suggestion that 32 or something, I think this wiki made, that cosmic rays came from neutron stars or something like that? Have you ever looked at that? I mean, I've never looked
at
it.
Well, I have since.
Is that just a fluke amongst a dozen suggestions?
That's right. It's a very insightful paper. It's just a two-page paper. It doesn't do any conviction. It has a lot of things that are wrong in it, too.
Yeah.
If you looked at it in hindsight, it was very imaginative.
In any case, it was not something...
Not something terribly helpful.
...that anyone followed up in any sense.
No, it's
just an isolated...
And also, I think even if you take it as it stands, he thought that the cosmic rays were born in the formation of the neutron star by some mysterious process that hadn't been talking about.
I see.
You know, all at once, bing, not by electromagnetic forces.
It wasn't a matter that they were accelerated.
No, it was a matter that God made them. You know, when you had a neutron star, you made cosmic rays. Mm. And that's what everybody sort of thought, because they were so strange, and they seemed to be all protons and neutrons and everything else. And that's why it was so exciting when these people first got data from the high atmosphere. They showed their heavies coming in. As soon as you saw a few heavies coming in, then qualitatively you said, this is not a fundamental way of making matter. It is the same old matter, somehow delicately accelerated. It accelerated so slowly that the nuclei didn't come apart.
Okay, so now having an interest in cosmic rays,
that's right.
Then how do you...
Well, having it was cosmic rays, then it was Fermi's work on the origin of cosmic rays. I thought I should do something of the same sort. You know, I had different ideas. I couldn't believe Fermi's theory exactly, and we modified it. And that was probably the first publication I did in cosmic ray field around 52 or 51. And then, of course, we were quite well aware of the relation between radio sources and cosmic rays, and we expect from these Herlovs and Alpha and Kipador.
Well, but now that was not really accepted in the field of radio astronomy.
Yeah, but it was easily accepted by the cosmic ray.
Many years later, I see.
Yeah.
Well, this is a rather striking difference, then. It took a long
time. Well, accepted is a strong word, I would say. It seemed plausible, right? One knew that the radio astronomers who talked about equivalent temperatures and stuff, suggesting a temperature was just silly. And the clincher to it was the 55, or it's a long time, 55, that's what I remember, because it was the big meeting at Guanajuato, where the Russians reported the polarization. Visible polarization. And so that was, I think, the beginning of the modern era.
And there was no quarrel with that data? I mean, look back at it, it looks rather shaky.
No. Really? I think the Russian data were rather poor. But by the time the meeting was over, Bott had already confirmed these photographs. So it was absolutely...
A combination of the two.
That's right. And Vulture written his famous thesis.
Also at that meeting, you knew about that?
We knew about that, yes. Yeah. He was doing it or something like that.
Yeah.
Or it was there, and he described what was going on. He fully believed it. So once the word accepted, so I think we all felt that, yes, indeed, the Kepler is a fascinating object. It's got something to do with astronomy, and these electrons are relativistic and polarized. And the whole story of looking for these things was good. That was certainly sometime 54, 55, 56.
So
now, before that, we had done, even that very time, I was working on time variation of cosmic rays in the solar system, which is not exactly the same problem. It's a related problem. It calls our attention, where do cosmic rays come from? We demonstrated they were galactic and not solar, and the solar coloration is inverse, and we start talking about diffusion of particles through fields and accelerations and all those things, which then were capped by Parker with the solar wind stuff, which came out later. So here, radio astronomy was not terribly significant, except to call one's attention to this observation of relativistic cosmic rays and radio astronomy.
I see. So is it fair to say then that during the early 50s, most physicists working in this field had no doubts about the synchrotron mechanism being active, and they thought that the radio data really was tying up with the cosmic rays, that the two definitely had something to do with each other?
Yeah, that's right. I would say not no doubts, but that it was a very hopeful suggestion. Mm-hmm. As soon as the Shlomsky Russian Bada work thing came out in the middle 50s, then it was kind of convinced.
Okay.
That's sort of the thing we're looking for.
This is what Ginsberg told me you might be interested in, that he had no doubts whatsoever from 1950 on. It just felt right that this was going to go.
I too felt it was going to go, but I wouldn't say I knew it. Just
yeah. Yeah.
There was no way to do it from temperature and so on. We just wanted to talk about this thing just there. I agree. I think that was the key.
Now, what about the connection, though, between... you have two sorts of things. You have these radio sources, these discrete sources, and you have There's a lot of argument in the early 50s anyway about whether they're in the galaxy or not. And yes. Then you have a diffuse background. Now, were you thinking of synchrotron radiation, as we now call it, as causing both of these?
Yes.
And what was the relation between them? Was the one the integral of the other, unresolved?
Well, no. One happened out in space where there were lots of clouds and weak fields. And one happened in some strange places where there were very strong fields. It got the particles going because magnetic field is what you need to make cosmic rays. At the same time, the things that make radio sources. So it looked all very, very good. The connection between radio sources and cosmic rays was very intense. And the Crab Nebula sort of over-clinched it because it's too easy. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I say from 55 on, I regard radio astronomy, radio sources and cosmic rays being the same. Now, what detail and where and so on.
Well, there's still the question mark, of course, as to what was giving the energy to these particles.
Of course,
that was just
a
question mark in the center, which
we
still have today with radio
sources.
That's right.
That's the whole point. You see, to some extent, I'm talking about the point of not getting answers, but of raising questions for research. It's obvious that it's interesting to try to come to the point of saying, what could the energy source be? Where would it be? And so on. But again, it was quite clear, you'll never find that out from cosmic rays, because they don't go in straight lines. That was the thing that sort of became very clear. And therefore, you want to look at these radio sources because that may be pointing to you where the cosmic ray source is, and the Crab Nebula was the best candidate.
Now, what about the contention at that time, and it still is an argument about the existence of a halo in the galaxy? Was this something that was necessary for cosmic ray people to have? If they didn't have a halo, then you didn't have something to confine the.
It was very natural. That's all. It was not necessary. Imagine. We took great satisfaction in Baldwin's measurements of the halo. But there are many theories. We discussed disks, we discussed halos. The geometry is something which goes way beyond the firmness of the conclusions you can draw from the theory. You'd be led by the geometry. It doesn't affect the
fundamental
idea.
Those are just details. Yeah.
They're details. I mean, they might be quite important. They wouldn't change the situation.
In a paper in Reviews of Modern Physics of 57 on the origin of cosmic rays, you mentioned the Crab and M87 also.
Yes.
Now, how would you tie in that case, clearly an extragalactic source?
Yes.
With our galaxy?
Yes.
Were you thinking that this was evidence that a whole halo of cosmic rays would be produced in M87, or that it was contributing to our own cosmic rays, or what?
Well, both, I think. I took the view that the low energy cosmic rays would be in our own galaxy, and the highest energy cosmic rays. Made in bigger objects than still that's true. And they might come to us across some space from the radio. And also the other radio sources were full of cosmic rays too.
So that it's special galaxies that are producing the
that's
high energy.
Right, special explosive galaxies.
Now, switching the subject to a little bit more general topic, in Nuovo Cimento in 58, you talked about the possibilities of doing gamma ray astronomy, which
yes.
Of course was a bit over several years off at that time. On radio sources specifically.
Yes.
I suppose this is because they were sites of high energy.
That's right, high energy. Relativistic electrons, therefore probably relativistic protons, and nuclei, therefore the collisions of those things, therefore nuclear gamma rays, Bremsstrahlung pair annihilation gamma rays, etc.
Now, I'm interested in that from a historical point of view, because it seems to me that radio astronomy really opened up the spectrum, and now we've opened up virtually every other range in the spectrum. Now, do you think is it true to say that the radio directly led on to trying to open up the gamma ray and perhaps other parts of the spectrum? Or would this have happened anyway if the technology had been such that the radio had been the last one to be opened up?
I think it would have happened as soon as you saw the polarization of the Crab Nebula. The optical polarization.
Okay. So the radio was not critical to wanting to do the
gamma. Well, it was viable because it was earlier, as you said.
Yeah. Well, that could be called a technological accident.
It could have been, yes. If the optical polarization had been found earlier, and one tried to explain the synchrotron as Shklovsky did and make it quite successful, with the right directions and the scale and all those things,
then
I think it would have been necessary to have the radio. It was essentially the strong continuum polarization that was the key. Now that was reinforced by the radio things.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say also, just as a general remark, that I think the radio people added to astronomy something much more important than any of these results even, and that is an up-to-date technology and attitude, which I feel optical astronomy has only very slowly come to, even now is not fully involved, and that's the most important thing they did.
Can you give some examples?
Well, for example, all radio shows are alpha azimuth telescopes, computer controlled.
Of course, they weren't then. I mean, that's taken a while even for them to
learn. I understand that, but it was only because there were some optical astronomers who were directed as radio observatories.
Yes, I can remember one telescope, right?
That's right. And so I think that's the thing that I would say. And they were interested in using electronics, they were using signal to noise, and they didn't use magnitudes or use flux units and things like that. They were all had, they had a much more physical... They came, of course, out of electrical engineering mostly, maybe some physics. And so they tightly unified astronomy with physics, which was much more difficult in the domain of the Palomars, which were photographic techniques and electronics. And as you said, you've got to have a long classical study of positional astronomy before you can become an astronomer. And, so.
Yeah.
And the idea of time scale, the idea even that objects are saved for people, all those things are characteristic. Not at all.
Yeah, and they still are.
That's right. That's right. So I feel that that's the biggest difference. Radio astronomy dragged astronomy into the world of physics.
And
that's its most important contribution.
And I suppose it'd be fair to say dragged physicists into astronomy also.
That's right.
Is that a revolution in itself?
Opened up the way to go into astronomy. There were physicists in astronomy. You see, even my thesis, when I was a student, I had 1/3 of it or 1/4 of it was due to astronomy. I liked astronomy. I wanted to get into it, just to know what to do.
What year was that?
1938 or something. Working on inverse beta decay processes in white dwarf stars and things like that.
I see.
You know, this internal stellar constitution from the physicist's point of view. The same thing that the beta was doing in physics then.
But essentially, the attitude that the radio astronomers brought in made it a more comfortable place for a physicist to be, are you saying?
Yes, and I think they made the experimental situation much better, whereas we just used, I remember very well going to see an astronomer, rather a good one, and discussing with him some statistical conclusion he had used in his paper. And I had to go away and realize that this man failed to understand the fundamental idea of statistics, the idea of independent variables. But he was a well-known astronomer with many papers on statistics.
This was an optical astronomer in about what year?
Classic, about 1937, I think, at Berkeley.
Well, let me change the topic slightly, because there's another famous paper, I have your bibliography before 1960, and that's the paper you did with Cocconi. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Searching
for interstellar communications, and I'm wondering, was that influenced by radio astronomy? I mean,
well, completely, but it didn't begin that way. It began out of gamma ray astronomy.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, the idea was that we realized that there was not many gamma rays, and we said, well, if you could make gamma rays that would cross space, they would be very significant against the background. So we began to think of whether you could communicate across space with gamma rays. Maybe for an hour. And then in the course of that hour of discussion, we each realized that already you could communicate much better than that. So that's why it came up.
In terms of less energy per quantum and all this stuff.
That's right. Directionality. The Arecibo telescope was already able to do this kind of thing. So there again, I think probably you would say that radio did provide the other spectral channel. And I think that's another thing I would say. I'd say generally that it's clear to me that you can't understand physics, of the universe without exploring every spectral channel. And as long as you have just one, namely optical, you're never going anywhere really. And therefore adding the second one is the definitive multiplication. But it cannot stop there. The most important one is probably the near infrared band. The near beta band, because that's what we use. So radio is very valuable. The radio is valuable primarily as a marker, showing here's one spectral band, and then finally you have this much bigger one, and now they have to do everything. And as you said, it's not really
important. It's an interesting question that I haven't quite resolved in my own mind as to the optical band does have an awful lot of the energy, because stars tend to have temperatures, which puts them, our eyes are adapted to the sun, which is a typical star, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
So that it's if you had to pick one band, it's perhaps the best one. Would you agree?
No
with
question.
That?
I would entirely agree with that, especially because it has so full of spectral ones. The optical band is the band of atomic transitions. So you learn about the matter from that. See, in radio, there are hardly any lines.
Well, we found a few in the last few years, but still.
Well, there are molecular lines, but not from hot objects and so on. They're very special. It's organic chemistry.
Well, that's a judgment, though, that hot objects are more interesting than fluons.
Well, from the point of view of energy sources. Let me rephrase it then.
Stars may form in cold areas, which. So
it's
ultimately,
true.
The energy sources come from the cold areas.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, where they form is another story. Maybe that would go to the geometric gravity. The physical processes associated with stars, and especially with non-thermal objects like cosmic ray production and radio production, and so on, must be relatively homogeneous regions. And the dust is certainly important, so I think that astronomy is certainly important. And I would say that you have, it seems pretty clear after my whole thing, I did the gamma ray too, you go to higher and higher energies to look for the sources of the energy that's pouring out.
This seems a little bit analogous to high energy physics.
Yeah. It's just
like trying to probe further in by...
That's right, try to probe more contact objects in earlier times and beginning of the process. This is actually an example from the second law of thermodynamics, that mostly things flow downhill. Not all the time, but mostly. And so you look uphill to get the place where things start.
Yeah. But going back, I...
Then the richness of stellar spectra, especially the high detail they get in spectroscopy, makes makes optical astronomy more important. There's really only one radio line that you find in large and extended radio sources.
Hydrogen. Is this a fundamental physical tie-up, the fact that the optical spectra are so rich, and the fact that most of the continuous radiation is given off in the optical band more than any other band? I'm trying to think now. It seems to me that's sort of a coincidence.
Well, but it isn't. You see, I guess it's true. Most of the radiation in the universe is in 3-degree radiation. That was, of course, atomic radiation. It's the recombination of radiation. It is continuous, so I guess you're right. That's what you have to say. That's the fundamental source. But of course, that's a very bland source. It doesn't tell you very much. And all the rest, then, is not. All the rest of continuous radiation, there's the thermal radiation from H2 regions and from atmospheres of stars and a galaxy. But look at a radio source and all those other things. Those are all things that are not at all atomic. And they have to do these bulk motion hurls and now fade far out of equilibrium.
Well, you've brought up the question of cosmology from a physicist's point of view in the 50s when the battle was raging between the log N, log S people, Mills versus Ryle, and the 2C survey, which you have to wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Steady state versus evolving cosmology came in.
Yes.
And how did a physicist view this?
Well, by that time, I think I was sort of an astronomer, at least in origin of cosmic rays. But I was very sympathetic to the steady state. It was such a beautiful theory. And I must say, I think that the log N, log S plot is useless, and I still think it's useless. It's an example of the Hubble program at its worst. If you can't identify the objects, I feel you don't understand their statistics. Unless you're very, very lucky, and that's still my view. So I'm not interested in surveys of that sort until they can show me that they can identify and describe the physics of each point in the diagram.
Even though they argued that no matter what the distribution, it didn't influence log N, log S.
But it's not true. It's not true. You can always superimpose local sources and all kinds of things you can do to influence log N, log S.
Oh, so, presuming that it was homogeneous.
But it's not homogeneous.
So, what was your view then? You say you were sympathetic?
Very sympathetic. In fact, I was at Cornell, and it was the Cornell group that first invited Bondi to come to this country. I think any of the three members, Bondi, first invited any of them to come to this country. We had Bondi come over. Can't say when, certainly in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Before he wrote his book on cosmology, he gave us lectures on the steady state. And we were very enthusiastic. We tried to save it and preserve it. And so we kept it this way pretty much, gradually getting less and less enthusiastic, and then finally giving up, I think, with the 3-degree discovery.
Did you yourself write papers trying to save the steady state, essentially, or, argue for it?
Don't know that I actually wrote any cosmological papers, but I thought about cosmology. Mm-hmm. I taught cosmology, so. Nothing salient. Maybe some remark that said this would be compatible with either cosmology or something like that. No big deal.
And the microwave background, your view, was in death analysis. Although, of course, as you know, Boyle is now trying to explain the microwave background in terms of the
He's trying, but he's not succeeding.
Yeah.
I've read all those papers, and much as I can understand, they do not make any show explaining the microwave background. They just wave their hands and say, well, maybe it occurs here, but there's no derivation.
No, they just say this is how it could come about.
So yeah, but they don't show it has a single temperature. I mean, that's the most fundamental thing.
This whole business of going back to interstellar communications, like I say, you came upon it after thinking about it for a short time, the radio band was a very useful way to do it.
Yes.
Do you think that this field would have exploded as it has in the last 5 or 10 years, really the last 5 years, if it hadn't been for radio?
No.
Astronomy, I mean, would people be thinking about?
No. I think radio astronomy is indispensable to the whole idea.
Has it really made it? What I'm trying to get at is, it's obvious, well, not obviously, but it's a really nice way to communicate, but does it really make one start to think more about other civilizations also? In other words, is the technology?
Well, you see, that's my point. I've always said that. Let me say what I think will clarify it. For us, for me and Giuseppe, certainly for me, I would say Giuseppe the same view. The speculation that there are other civilizations is palpably is demonstrable. It goes back. You can't find any classical authors in that possibility. But the thing that is new about our time is it has become an empirical problem. And if you ask yourself, how could we communicate to this day in 1976 with a star 10 light years away, with light or sound or heat or x-rays or gamma rays or anything, you name it, there's no way we can make our presence known even 10 light years away, or even 10,000 light years away, with anything that we know about that we have built now, except radio dishes. Mm-hmm. You can imagine building lasers that would do it, but they weren't built yet. You could imagine. I think it could be done. It's way beyond us.
Yeah, very inefficient.
That's right, and it's way beyond us. It would take $1 million, $100 million. I mean, maybe you can do it. But the radio can do it, and only can do it, but has done it for 10 years.
Yeah.
And signals not only that, but signals 100 kiloparsecs. No great problem. So I think that radio is just enormously important. Giving a sense that it's realistic and not pure speculative.
Which then makes one begin to think much more about the whole general question of what sort of civilizations there might be, how many.
Yeah, at least it fixes that context. Nobody did that until these things. Yeah. That's the idea. That's what I keep saying. It's not that we had the new idea to speculate. That was not new. The new idea was there may be an empirical means of finding out.
Okay, straying even perhaps a bit further, I can't resist. Someone made the comment to me, and I never quite thought of this before, that, well, I know who it was. It was Hewish, that if extraterrestrial life were discovered, that it would not be a scientific discovery. That it would be incredibly fascinating, et cetera, but it would not be a scientific discovery, therefore perhaps not suitable for a Nobel Prize or whatever. I'd be interested in your comments on that.
That's interesting. I've said exactly the same thing. I'm not sure you didn't get it from me. I'd like to know when I said it, because I've been saying, I'll tell you frankly, too, a couple of reasons. First reason is, I think intrinsically it's true, that it's not scientific, because it is the nature of exploration. Exploration has always been distinguished from science. Why? Because the outcome is not the satisfactory, not just testing hypothesis and developing theory. The outcome is some great, complex consequence. We find beings out there, that's not going to just change our theories, but it's going to have a long, when Columbus discovered America, it didn't just change the geographical statement about continents, it made a huge thing open up. And you ask, where would it be published? It would be published in the Journal of the History of Astronomy, the Journal of the Astrophysical Journal, the Astronomical Journal, the New York Times, Time Magazine. I've seen published everywhere. You see, that's another way of answering. Right. It doesn't just need a specialized sort of thing. So I have said, too, that it is exploration, not science. Employing science, but not itself science.
But there is a scientific component to the discovery also.
Of course, there's always. The same thing when you discovered America. There's an enormous scientific component, but it wasn't just restricted to that.
Okay.
So the kind of scientific discovery underestimates it.
Okay.
Puts it in the wrong context.
Well, I get the feeling that Hewish was saying that it just plain had no science in it, that it was more some sort of other activity. I mean, maybe I'm just really...
Well, I disagree with you. Okay. There's a lot of science in it. But if you see, it depends what you think of science. If you think of science as being, as I say, the things that are within the reach of the specialists that make the next chapter of the Physical Review, then it's not science. But if you think of it as being the fundamental thing, for example, I would say the fundamental thing is that the laws of nature have a certain uniformity and that evolution is a generalized process. That's what demonstrates that more than anything else.
Right.
So I regard that as very important in science, but going much beyond science. And also not very detailed in it doesn't matter much. Doesn't care. But somebody does, and it's nice to have a result that cuts you in 16 different ways. So I would say, yes, it is more than science, not less than science. It includes science, it transcends science.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one reason for saying this is that I think the effort and expenditures to make it should not be charged, so to speak, to the budget of science. And it's very important for me to say that I don't feel so strongly about it, but many people do feel strongly about it, and I'm anxious to gain their support and not alienate them by saying, well, I think this is the most important thing in science, we take away your scientific activities and turn them into finding out about this matter.
Are you saying it's something that maybe HEW or Interior Department should put money out for rather than just NSA? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I would say NASA should just NSA.
Of course they are, to some extent.
They are. It's the exploration of space rather than developing the new science. Yeah. So it comes in a different pocket, a different category. And I would not be amazed, though I'd be a little surprised at the moment, if we had some sort of initial hints of things like, well, if Viking really showed living forms that were strong, I would not be surprised to see a new agency made solely for this purpose. Maybe for this purpose. It would not be possible. But that's what I mean. It would not just be a piece of the NSF budget. Where would it come from? The biology budget, the astronomy budget, the communications budget, the linguistic budget, the social studies budget. You know, it doesn't make sense. It cuts across everything. In that sense, it's not science. And I think exploration, we have a category. Exploration is a very good one. See, to some extent, NSF does support exploration, but not fully. They have a hard time.
National Geographic Society.
National Geographic Society, definitely. You see, NSF supports Antarctic exploration, but the Navy threw in the whole logistic cost. And that's exactly the idea.
So, would you agree that if interstellar communication were established with some other form of civilization, this perhaps might be radio astronomy's greatest contribution?
Yes.
Rather than something to do with a microwave background or pulsars?
Yes, but it might not be its deepest contribution, right? You want to have the greatest impact. Go deeper into worlds and natures.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
That ends the interview with Phil Morrison on 6 September 76.